Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. So if you're familiar with the hand-finger convention from philosophy discussion periods, where a hand begins a new line of questioning and a finger is a follow-up, I am allowed to use my finger. And the second ground rule is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are, and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Yes, I'm Susan Wolf. I teach philosophy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And I work in ethics, all kinds of ethics. The probably main things I've focused on in my career is our free will and moral responsibility, the structure of morality, the relation between moral and non-moral values, and meaningfulness in life.
Great. Thank you, Susan. It's good to have you here. So my inspiration is Iris Murdoch, who I know is someone who has been important for at least some of your work. It was, I think, someone you cite in Freedom Within Reason. And she begins every episode of this podcast telling us that philosophy is certainly not self-expression. She also wrote, this is a quote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth." So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Well, before answering that question, I just wanted to reaffirm that, yes, Iris Murdoch is one of my superheroes who's had probably as much influence on my philosophical thought as anyone. And that, therefore, when you invited me to do this and mentioned or used her words as your opening, I think the way I might put it is you had me at Iris Murdoch.
So, yes.
Also, I take her, the quotation, to and agree with it, to have the idea that everyone's philosophy is influenced by their temperaments. It's not a question of whether, but whether one notices that it is, and also if one knows how your temperament influences your work. I'm sure that my temperament does influence my work, that it shapes it probably in a lot of different ways, both in what questions I'm likely to ask, how I approach answering them, and the style in which I write or talk about them. But I'm less confident that I know my own temperament or how it shows itself in my work. I mean, I can make some guesses, but other people might actually be a better position to see than I am. I kind of suspect that my personality comes through pretty strongly in my work. It doesn't in everyone's, but it probably does in mine. Understanding temperament broadly as sort of all the non-rational aspects of one's approach to life or something like that. I think there are three things that I'm attracted to that don't always go together and that have a lot of in shaping what the way I do philosophy. So the three things are that I like clarity and precision. I like big, ambitious questions. And I like to think through the details of human life. I mean, I think for a lot of people, clarity and precision goes with small questions. and that, you know, with big questions, you have to kind of sacrifice a bit of clarity, or you have to get very abstract. And I sort of like to stay close to the ground, but still see, well, but I still want to know about the meaning of life.
Those constraints make it hard to reach conclusions. I mean, there's a kind of challenge in figuring out how to say something about big questions like the meaning of life in a way that remains grounded and that is sufficiently clear. And you do have views about those questions. You've defended views about the meaning of life, what makes a life meaningful. So question two is, do you believe those philosophical views? I mean, what's your attitude to the kinds of conclusions you're able to reach?
While I'm writing them, I absolutely believe what I'm writing. I don't think I could bring myself to to write about or talk about views in a way that wasn't completely sincere. But there's a kind of double vision, especially with respect to big questions. What's meaningfulness in life? What's the solution to the problem of free will? Which is that even though as I'm writing, I'm thinking, yes, this is the solution to the problem of free will. This is what meaning amounts to. There's a double vision where I think, look, I can't really be getting this right. I mean, people have been working on this for hundreds of years. This is, you know, I know I'm not as smart as a lot of these people, but so I'm sort of both believing it completely and realizing that it's probably full of error.
I mean, you have a view about meaning in life, about what makes a meaningful life, on which it involves objective value, doing things that are objectively valuable in a way that's subjectively satisfying. And that involves a kind of faith in the idea of objective value that at least in your book on meaning in life, you express some ambivalence about, or at least sort of uncertainty about how to establish or articulate or defend. I mean, is that something that, despite your philosophical reservations, you would say you believe in, that value, that the kind of objective value that you think is required for us to have meaningful lives?
Oh, well, I'm not sure I can answer this question directly, but when I said, look, I really care about clarity and precision, but also about big questions. Part of the way one can have both is by being clear and precise about exactly how far along one is able to answer those questions and where one's answers give out. So what I believe is that, you know, meaning in life involves a commitment to objective value. I realize that it raises the question, well, so what, you know, let's have an account of what objective value is such that we can be confident that there is such a thing. And I wanted to be clear that I don't have an account. I guess I do, however, my thought about that is I don't think that what I need for the sense of objective value that I think meaningfulness requires is something metaphysically very strange or mysterious. I mean, even though I call my view objective, I think there are lots of people who think, no, what I really believe or think I need, at least, is what they would not call objective, but something much more, you know, it's anthropocentric. So I do believe that, I guess what I believe and what I think is necessary for my views on meaning is that some things are a lot more worth doing than others. And that when I say that, I'm not just saying to me they're more worthwhile than others. I think there's a kind of standard external to me and that isn't reducible to what everybody thinks there is that makes some things more worthwhile than others, that, you know, collecting the big, you know, a big ball of string is, I should say this with some qualification, that, you know, but start with some intuitively plausible view, like collecting the biggest ball of string in the world is less worthwhile than curing the coronavirus. One could question that, but then if one questions that, one's still appealing to standards by which, if one's wrong, one will come to see that as wrong, and that where it's, again, there's a fact of the matter. So yeah, I do believe that, and I believe that therefore, you know, when we ask ourselves, you know, is what I'm doing with my life worth doing? Yeah, some answers are better than others.
Speaking of things that are worth doing, maybe objectively worth doing. I take it that you think that philosophy is one of them. But question three is, if you weren't a philosopher, do you have an idea of what you would do instead?
Well, since I enrolled in graduate school, I've always had a backup plan. So even though I don't know whether I would have succeeded at it, the backup plan was, if philosophy doesn't work out, I will try to become a pastry chef.
Okay.
So, yes, another worthwhile thing to do, it seemed to me.
When did you give up on that plan? Like, when did you finally decide, or have you finally decided, yes, it's philosophy now, the pastry chef plan is back on the shelf?
Yeah, have I even given up on it now? I mean, I think I've given up on becoming really good at the, you know, most challenging kinds of pastry, but, you know, I still think, oh, it wouldn't be a bad thing to open up a, you know, a bakery where I could do the kinds of things I can already do pretty well, chocolate chip cookies and brownies and, you know, certain kinds of other yummy things. But, I don't think it was so much a matter of giving up. I sort of stumbled into philosophy and went to graduate school on the condition that I had a fellowship and didn't have to borrow money or, you know, ask my parents for money. And I sort of kept going thinking, well, you know, if things go okay, if I get a job, fine. If I don't, you know, move to plan B. And I've been very fortunate. So, yeah, so I don't really want to give up philosophy, but that alternate world might have been as full of tension and difficulty and maybe even worse than philosophy. So I think I would have enjoyed it and been rewarded by it.
Well, at this point, I want to go back to philosophy. Although actually, now that I look at the question I have written down, it's a bit more open-ended than that. The question is, who was your most inspiring teacher? And I guess that I was imagining that was a philosophy teacher, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like the idea of having to answer with just one person.
That's fine.
So there's one undergraduate philosophy teacher, one graduate philosophy teacher, and before that, my English teacher freshman year in college. I guess they were the three people who I think were most inspiring in directing me in the ways I've gone. So the philosophy ones, which are probably of most interest, Bob Foglin was teaching at Yale when I was there, and he... So he taught me Intro to Philosophy. He was an incredibly gifted teacher, and his Intro to Philosophy course had 600 people in his lectures.
Wow.
So, which is a lot for any philosophy course. And it turned me on in an amazing way. But then he kind of took me under his wing. I had several, one-on-one tutorials with him later on. And he was just... I mean, what was wonderful and inspiring was this combination of things that, I mean, he was just incredibly smart and was an incredibly insightful reader of texts, and he loved it. He just loved reading, thinking through philosophy. And it just sort of was so contagious. And so the way he taught his courses, it was all text-based. You know, philosophy, Intro to Philosophy was, you know, here are six great books and let's get through them. And they were always, he always sort of made the best of each of them. So you just go from one to the next to the next. And he just got you hooked, or got me hooked, in the enterprise of trying to understand and think through these great thinkers, great ideas. I remember it included Spinoza's Ethics as one of the first books I ever read in philosophy, which is an extremely daring thing to do, given how hard it is. And I think that was really what got me. I just thought, wow, this is great to think that big and that wildly. and yet with such clarity and rigor. Anyway, so that was number one. Number two was Thomas Nagel, who's my dissertation advisor. Very different style. I'm not sure that it always seemed like fun. It just, I think with one of the things that was so impressive was the total selflessness of the way he did philosophy. The selflessness and kind of intellectual courage. I mean, he would just search for truth and be willing to entertain, you know, very controversial ideas, there was just a kind of intellectual honesty and seriousness about it all that was also quite wonderful.
By selflessness, do you mean a kind of willingness to be wrong, a kind of willingness to criticize one's own views rather than defend oneself?
Actually, I mean something more like an absolute absence of self-consciousness or self. I mean, it was as if he was. So, an anecdote that's relevant to this is that he never assigned or even mentioned his own work. Once I started taking his classes, I took or sat in on every class he offered. I TA'd for him, and I met with him every week for 2 years while I was writing my dissertation. And he never once mentioned, I have a view on this.
Wow.
So the end of the anecdote, this is embarrassing, but mentioning it anyway, is that because I was never very scholarly and I read slowly, I didn't actually read a lot of his work until I had handed in my dissertation. It was in the hands of the readers. And I finally thought, well, I have some time now. Why don't I read The Possibility of Altruism, which he had never mentioned. And I read it and I think, oh, well, I don't know what kinds of words I can even. Anyway, I realized that he must have known all along that I had never read this book because it was completely relevant to things I had been writing about. He never said, oh, you know, you might look at this. Anyway, so it was, to me, quite embarrassing that I hadn't read it. But so the selflessness is, it's as if the fact that he had a view at all wasn't even relevant. So, I mean, it kind of follows he could admit he was wrong. I mean, it's as if he had forgotten that he ever had a view. He's just sort of in there with the problem. Yeah, I think that's a great way to be.
I'm going to end, as always, by going back to Iris Murdoch and another quotation. It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher, she wrote. What is she afraid of? So what are you afraid of?
I have to say, when I first read that question, I immediately went to sort of thinking literally of, you know, do I have any phobias? What kinds of things make me feel fear? And I don't think I do have any phobias there. Though I'm a fearful and anxious person, I don't think that's quite the same. I mean, I get afraid of, driving in bad weather and biking in traffic, and I get very anxious about public speaking, including podcasts. But
okay.
But that said, I then realized, well, those kinds of fears actually aren't especially interesting to ask the philosophers. They don't really tell you very much about anything that would connect, for example, to their philosophy, as opposed to maybe some fear of death would, I think, plausibly connect to philosophy, but I don't actually think I have much of a fear of death. So I had to think a little bit longer, and I think what I am afraid of is being a jerk and being seen to be a jerk. Not unconnected. And then I thought, oh, that actually explains why I'm so anxious about public speaking.
Interesting. Do you think it has being afraid to be and being seen to be a jerk? Does that have other connections with your philosophy? I mean, you've worked on moral responsibility and culpability. Is there a connection there?
I guess there is. That wasn't, that is, if you're not responsible, then being a jerk probably wouldn't have the same, I mean, you wouldn't, there wouldn't be as much reason to be afraid of being a jerk if you weren't responsible. But I think, so I do think there might be a connection in my interest and in feeling that I really am responsible, and that therefore whether or not I'm a jerk is on me. I mean, I guess it's a deep belief that I'm responsible, such that if I am a jerk, it's on me. If I'm not, that's something I can be proud of, or at least, you know, and all of those things kind of assume responsibility. And so that might be why I'm so interested in responsibility. The thing that once I realized this is something I'm really afraid of, the way I connected that to my philosophy was actually more in connection with my thoughts about meaning in life, because what it shows about me is that I'm thinking about myself from the outside in some way. Like, that is, from the inside, I'm not a jerk. I'm just me, but I have this fear that sort of a person of good judgment looking at me from without might recognize that I am a jerk, even though from the inside, I'm not aware of that. And just to have that tendency, maybe that's also part of my temperament, to sort of wonder about what I am looking at it from the outside, is connected to my thought that meaning in life is connected to an interest in being able to look at one's life from the outside and say it wasn't pointless or a waste or ridiculous.
That's a great connection, and I think a great note to end on. Thank you so much for appearing on the podcast and being the opposite of a jerk. And it's been great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Susan Wolfe. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's the author of several books, including Meaning in Life and Why It Matters, which is both a great book and I think a very accessible book for anyone interested in philosophy or ethics or how to live. Thank you for listening to Five Questions.